It's The Ancients on History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host. And in today's episode, well, it was fantastic to see how well received our Wonders of the World miniseries proved in March. And so we kind of decided to do an Ancients Encore. Another great architectural marvel of antiquity, a monument that has become the face of ancient Egyptian culture alongside Tutankhamun and the pyramids. I am, of course, talking about the Great Sphinx of Giza, one of the, if not the oldest surviving monumental sculpture in the world. It's colossal and still stands to this day. Now, a few weeks back, I headed to Manchester Museum to finally go and see their highly praised exhibition on ancient Egypt called Golden Mummies. It is fantastic, but only on for a few more weeks, so do make sure you go and see it before it's not too late. I've done some videos all about it on my Instagram page at AncientsTristan if you need further convincing. Now, whilst I was at Manchester Museum, I caught up with its ancient Egypt curator, Dr. Campbell Price, because Campbell, he is also an expert on the Great Sphinx, so he is our guest for today's episode. I really do hope you enjoy. And here's Campbell. Campbell, it is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Hello again, Tristan. Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you in person.
We're doing it in person this time, and what a scenic place to do it. This is behind the scenes of the Manchester Museum too.
Yes, this is our archery store that we're sat in at the moment, so bows and arrows and lots of books.
We are talking about the Sphinx, and this has to be one of the most recognisable and colossal statues, not just in ancient Egypt, but in the ancient world.
Yeah, I think the Great Sphinx of Giza, which is associated with the pyramids of Giza, the Great Pyramid and the two other pyramids there on the plateau, that is the largest single rock cut sculpture in Egypt. I can't speak for everywhere else in the world, you have to fact check that. But in terms of ancient Egyptian sculpture, which, and the ancient Egyptians loved a colossal statue, that is the biggest one.
You mentioned there, next to these other great pyramids and the Great Pyramid, the wonder of the ancient world. So, I mean, set the scene for us so we know exactly where we're talking about here. Where is this in ancient Egypt?
So the site today called Giza is southwest of modern Cairo. It is actually on the fringes of the city. If you've taken a flight into Cairo, you can see the edge of the desert, and people imagine the pyramids are in the middle of the desert like a Hollywood movie. Actually, they are sort of encompassed by the conurbation. And so in ancient times, this was the royal cemetery. So we're talking about the 4th dynasty. So maybe around about 2600 BC.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a long time ago. Yeah. And these are the tombs of the kings, and they are big at the time. They're the biggest pyramids constructed in Egypt. And much debate concerns the date and the original identity of the Sphinx. So we'll leave the pyramids to one side. The kings who are responsible are King Khufu. He builds the Great Pyramid at Giza. His son and eventual successor, Khafre, builds the second one. And then his son, Menkaure, builds the third one. The Sphinx is this human-headed lion sculpture that is excavated, it's quite clear if you're visiting there, out of a quarry, what must have been used to extract stone, because for the most part, the Giza pyramids are built of stone that was quarried very close by. So it's the path of least resistance. The really nice stone comes from opposite bank of the Nile, the nice white limestone that would have faced it. So you would have had, and you can imagine almost being the architect that said, hang on, guys, that area of the quarry kind of looks like a lion. So let's lean into that. Maybe it was an intention all the time. Let's sculpt it formally as an image of the king.
When we say the word Sphinx, is that mythical beast, is it always a body of a lion and the head of a human? What do we know about the actual mythological animal of the Sphinx?
We are reliant on Greek sources often in Egyptology because they are the ones who encounter the Egyptians because they come along chronologically. Well, you know the story around and after the time of Alexander. You know better than most. But the Greeks have an idea of what a Sphinx is. In Greek mythology, the Sphinx tends to be female. In Egyptian iconography, the Sphinx is usually, but not exclusively, male. It has the body of a lion, no wings usually, and the head of the king. So the first Sphinx, the great Sphinx of Dynasty 4, there may be a couple of precursors, possibly representing royal women, but the great Sphinx of Giza is simply to show, I think, the superhuman power of the king. It embodies something more than a human being. So the ancient Egyptians do this thing where they take something threatening and make it something protective or something divine or something positive. So hippos, crocodiles, scorpions, snakes, lions. So it's fairly likely the ancient Egyptians would have encountered lions on the desert fringes. They're quite scary things. So they take the idea of the power, the strength of the lion, and they give it the king's head, and that makes the Sphinx. The word Sphinx comes from the Greek. The ancient word, well, it depends. There is one term called the Sesshet Ankh, which means something like the living image. And I like that term because it gets to the heart of what Egyptian sculpture is really all about, ancient Egyptian sculpture, and that is a vessel for spiritual entities. So images, statues are living. So the Sphinx is a living image.
So it's not just a nice piece of artwork that they created. It has a lot of meaning. It's powerful. It's almost a magical object.
Yes, yes. It's absolutely imbued with power. It's to be feared. And the modern Arabic term for the Sphinx of Giza, Abu Hall, which is something like the father of fear, gets to the point, which is the pharaoh is to be feared. The pharaoh is a scary, powerful intermediary between regular people, normal people, humanity, and the world of the gods. And so the Sphinx is a way of expressing that power.
This is interesting, I guess, when you're talking about that kind of hybrid of an animal and a human, you also think, with those animals that you mentioned, you think of the Egyptian pantheon of gods and how they're depicted, aren't they? They always, time and again, they have that hybrid depiction. It almost seems to be a similar thing with the creation of the Sphinx.
Yes, and it's a kind of inversion of the usual pattern, which is you have animal-headed gods. Here is a human-headed animal. And it just emphasizes, and Egyptian art does this, pharaonic art does this a lot. You take one element of the uncanny, what to us seems uncanny and strange looking, bizarre looking, and you then create this expression of difference and power. So in the case of the gods, yeah, a jackal-headed man or a lioness-headed woman emphasize different divinities. In some ways, the Sphinx starts out as a statement of the godliness of the pharaoh. So it's the godliness of a living person.
Now, you mentioned the fourth dynasty and these pharaohs that are associated with creating those majestic monuments on the Giza plateau. When it comes to the Great Sphinx, which pharaoh do we think oversaw its construction? You're smiling when I ask you that question.
Right. So much debate on this. Some people will tell you that the Sphinx started out depicting entirely a lion and that it's 10,000 years old. I'm not sure I believe them.
I'm not sure.
I have good friends who worked on the Sphinx at Giza as archaeologists. I have friends who are geologists. And the balance of opinion seems to be the Sphinx is made of different qualities of stone. And the debate centers on how the stone is eroded. For some people, it looks like water erosion. For others, it's wind erosion, and it's simply different layers of stone have eroded at different points. I do not think that the Sphinx started out as a lion. The size, the relative size of the head, the human head on the Sphinx, is simply a result of it having been carved relative to people probably on the ground. It's not a comment necessarily on the total form of the Sphinx initially. So the jury is out between King Khafre, so that's the builder of the middle pyramid at Giza, and then King Khufu, the big pyramid, the great pyramid builder. I could believe potentially that it was Khufu who conceptualized it and Khafre who finished it off. But we can say, if you look at a basic archaeological plan of Giza, the pyramid complexes, you'll see the causeway, this kind of connecting avenue between the pyramid and the temple near the Nile, kind of veers off as if to respect the Sphinx area. So it seems that Khafre's building complex included it. It existed already. So that's why I think either Khufu or his son Khafre were responsible.
Before this time, in the archaeology, is there any evidence that this idea of a sphinx, I mean, was it popular amongst Egyptian pharaohs, or is this, does this seem like something quite new at the time of the Fourth Dynasty?
I think the idea of a sphinx, a human-headed lion, is fairly recent to the Fourth Dynasty. There's not much evidence of the existence of that kind of thing before. You get already at the foundation of the state, so-called, air quotations, King Narmer, who's the first king of Egypt, is shown on his famous palette, which is this monumental like tablet showing the victory of Narmer, king of the south, over the people of the north. The king can take on the form of a bird. So there's already this idea of the king can be an animal. And then you get a representation of monstrous, mythical kind of animals, which are, they look feline, but they have very long necks. So the idea of a superhuman animal already exists then. So in some ways, I think the Sphinx is a kind of logical progression. What made the Egyptians create that idea on such a scale at that time, I can't tell you. That's a mystery.
Well, you hinted at earlier how the local stones, they are used in the construction on the Giza Plateau a lot.
Yes.
So do we know much, I mean, with the pyramids, we have like the Red Sea Scrolls and stuff like that, but do we know much about the actual construction of the Sphinx?
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, so we do know something about at least the scheduling, if not the actual technical know-how of constructing pyramids, thanks to papyrus sources. Actually carving the Sphinx, no, we don't. It's scooped out of this kind of bay, this kind of basin, and if it were like other Egyptian sculptures of any size, you would expect two teams to be working on it. So you have two distinct groups working on the same project. Whether it was like that then, we have no definitive evidence. More evidence comes from later on in its history, and I mean centuries and millennia after the first carving, where people go along and patch it up. So there is a lot of repair work, which continues to now, to the present day. So no, we can say almost nothing about its, the techniques of its construction. We can say it was painted vividly. You know, I kind of imagine the recreation Sphinx outside the Luxor Casino and Hotel in Las Vegas is an approximation, but maybe it's not that far from the original appearance of the Sphinx. So the headcloth, the Nemi's headcloth, would be yellow and blue stripes.
Oh, that's the iconic headdress we see on pharaohs, yes, yeah.
Like Tutankhamun's famous mask. And then the flesh seems to have been a reddy browny colour, because there are traces you can even see still there. Whether those were the traces from the original painting, I'm sceptical of. I think it was given several recoats over the thousands of years of its veneration. But we can say it was painted. The style of the face is consistent with the Fourth Dynasty. So we have other sculptures we can compare it to. Of course, it's conditioned by the size of the sculpture, I guess. But I'm quite happy saying, yes, it's a Fourth Dynasty conception. It was finished in the Fourth Dynasty. But then it goes on to have this rather interesting afterlife.
We'll get to that very soon. But a really important question, first of all. Did the original Sphinx have a nose?
Yes. Yes, it was not carved without a nose.
Good. Well, actually, one last thing on the building. We think of the Sphinx itself, the colossal statue, but was there any buildings almost surrounding the Sphinx? Was it just the Sphinx, or was there a whole enclosure almost?
Oh, now this is interesting. There is evidence, well, surviving right in front of it is a Sphinx temple. So a temple dedicated to the Sphinx. The date of this is also somewhat vexatious. It's quite confusing. So the structure of it seems to be consistent with the Fourth Dynasty, right? But the construction is quite, it appears quite archaic, even for the Fourth Dynasty. So the temple in front of the Sphinx was conceptualized in the Fourth Dynasty, so it's consistent, it's contemporary with the Sphinx. Then there's maybe slightly later, Khafre has his own temple, Valley Temple, constructed. So they are an important part of the, you know, no Egyptian monument is really totally isolated. You always have some ancillary buildings. So at Giza, with the Sphinx later on, and we're talking hundreds of years later, 1,000 years later, other buildings start to pop up.
Can I also ask quickly about the wall, the potential wall which surrounded the whole Sphinx too? Because I know this is something you've had a bit of a look at.
I have, and I am fascinated by this. So, one word for the enclosure of the Sphinx that we have from sources, hieroglyphic sources, is setepet. And the setepet means literally the most select or the most restricted. Okay? So, maybe, gosh, 1,000 years after the Sphinx is constructed, kings in the New Kingdom come along and they enclose that area in a mud brick wall. And I've had a good look at the mud brick wall myself, and it's consistent with the New Kingdom, so 1,000 years after the construction of the Sphinx. And this would suggest that it creates a space that is the select area where only those and such as those could get in. But it also highlights what for me is a fascinating aspect of the Sphinx. People couldn't just wander up to it and touch it. You had to be a priest to get in. And we know this of temples. Major temples had big, intimidating walls around them. Bigger statues also did. There are other cases of this. So I think this is what happens with the Sphinx. There is a big construction that stops this magical, powerful statue being touched by the hoi polloi. And it also has the practical function of keeping away the sand, which is always threatening to encroach the body of the Sphinx, which indeed happened several times in its history.
But do we have no idea then if the wall, there was any original wall at the time of the 4th dynasty? Is this purely a late construction, or could it have been built on top of an earlier wall?
I think there must have been something there. I mean, how archaeologically attested that is, I'm not sure. What remains there now seems very clearly to be much later, but as you say, it could be placed on top of an original wall. Mm.
And one last thing on the 4th dynasty, let's say it was King Khafre that oversaw its final piece, and it's Khafre who's looking at you there. Mm-hmm. That whole idea of accessibility, I mean, do we know much about Khafre's reign? Was he someone who would have wanted to create one of those statues and the hoi polloi would see from a distance his face in this mythical, magical creature? I mean, is this a key part of Khafre's story? Do we know much about that at all?
Well, sadly, Tristan, we don't know much about Khafre anyway, and this is all just the supposition, as it often is in Egyptology. So we don't know anything about him as a personality, but we do know his dynasty think of themselves and say that they are directly the sons of the sun god. They style themselves Sa-Ra in ancient Egyptian, son of the sun god. So maybe his own conception of his own divinity would have matched someone who would want to be depicted as a king-headed lion. So you can't build a massive sculpture like the Sphinx and not want to declare some statement. But I think the main audience for that statement, contrary maybe to popular belief nowadays, was the gods. It's not the general population. Sure, of course, people would marvel at the pyramids and you would take some of the credit, I guess, by having a sculpture of yourself created there. But there's no definitive inscription that says this is Khafre. There's no name preserved. It is only later kings, New Kingdom kings, that use the name Khafre in their own texts which talk about the Sphinx. So it's all kind of supposition.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, host of Dan Snow's History Hit podcast here. History isn't just dates and facts. It's about the incredible stories that shape our world. 3 times a week on my podcast, my expert guests and I bring you extraordinary stories of heroism, discovery, mystery, and power. Expect tales of lost tombs, daring escapes, power-hungry rulers, and those determined to bring them all down. If you're a history lover or just looking for a good tale, you'll want to check out Dan Snow's History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, I've got to ask then, because the other sites from that similar time, and I'm thinking because I've been there quite recently, Orkney and Macehow, and you see...
Sure, yeah.
Like I think it's on the shortest day of the year that the sun shines through into the centre of the chamber and it's beautiful, and Stonehenge is a similar kind of thing as well. You mentioned this association with the Fourth Dynasty and the sun god. Is there any potential alignment with the Sphinx, with the sun, or like any sort of kind of astronomical link in its design?
Well, it's orientated to face due east, so it's looking at the sunrise. So we can take that as read. But the pyramids behind also are orientated correctly, pretty much to the cardinal points. What happens later is the Sphinx develops another exclusively divine identity. The association with Khafre is almost forgotten, and the Sphinx is worshipped as a god in its own right. So the stone is divine. And the name the Egyptians choose to give the Sphinx is Har-em-Akhet. And that means literally the god Horus in the horizon. So there is something, a kind of reinterpretation maybe going on, which may have gone on for centuries, but it's only written down or spoken about directly in the New Kingdom around 1400 BC, where the Sphinx, which if you look at it from a certain angle, is the head between two pyramids. And we do have actually some ancient depictions of the Sphinx in that arrangement. The two pyramids could be thought to write the word Akhet, which means horizon. So Horus in the horizon is simply a form of the god Horus, also a form of the sun god. These two ideas can be simultaneous in the horizon. So it's kind of a 3D writing of a hieroglyphic idea, which the ancient Egyptians loved a pun. So I don't think the Egyptians were as bothered about alignments, celestial alignments, as we are.
You know, I think you're exactly right, and I think it's the same. I think we sometimes really want to try and find an alignment, but sometimes look for one that isn't there, and you see it with monuments all across the world, and sometimes they're linked to more difficult interpretations.
Yes, I do think that's right, and I think maybe it is that certain monuments are built in respect to each other rather than to celestial phenomena. Yeah.
Well, let's go on to this. We've been hinting at it. You've been mentioning little hints of it for long enough now. Let's go on to this kind of revival of the Sphinx.
Yeah, the Sphinx revival.
The Sphinx revival, but also in ancient Egyptian times, which is kind of weird to say, but that just really emphasizes just, you know, how long ancient Egyptian culture lasts. So when are we talking with like the revival of the Sphinx in ancient Egypt?
So we know there's kind of a period of silence between the Fourth Dynasty, pretty much, and the New Kingdom. Clearly things are happening at Giza.
A New Kingdom, that's 2nd millennium BC.
This is, yeah, 2nd millennium BC into what we would call the Bronze Age in other parts of the world and archaeology in general. So we're talking in Egyptological terms about particularly the reign of King Amenhotep II and King Thutmose IV. So this is father and son. And they are around in the 1400s BC. So remember, this is over 1,000 years after the Sphinx has been carved. Amenhotep II comes along and he plonks a fairly nice temple right in front of the Sphinx. It is visible today, you can visit it today, and it's quite high up. So if you step out of the front door of this temple, you're eyeballing the Sphinx kind of from the side. Now, Amenhotep II has a son, Thutmose IV, as he becomes king. Now, he leaves us the great dream stela, which is this enormous limestone tablet, which is between the Sphinx's paws. When you go and visit today or you see photographs, there is this monument in between the paws of the Sphinx. This belongs to King Thutmose IV. And he tells this vivid story of being a kind of boy racer as a prince, not expecting to be the king. And he goes out to Giza to go hunting So he's got his bows and arrows, presumably, hence appropriate we're in the Manchester Museum archery store at the moment. And he goes out for a hunt. He's hunting lions. And he does his hunting. He stops for a nap. And he sleeps in the shadow of the Sphinx because it's a hot day. And the Sphinx provides some shade. Now, there is a little religious added meaning here that the Sphinx itself is said to have the shade of the god on it. Sphinxes have this especially divine quality. And often in two-dimensional art, when a Sphinx is shown, you will see the image of a fan, a shade behind the Sphinx, right? So the fact that Thutmose IV says he has a nap in the shade of the Sphinx means that the shadow of godliness and kingship is on him, right? So there's a deliberate reference there. So in this dream, he has a dream while he's asleep. He dreams that the Sphinx comes to life as a god and speaks to him. And the god says, please, I'm, you know, covered in sand. If you remove the sand from around my body, you will become the Pharaoh of Egypt. So when he wakes up, he says to his flunkies, okay, chaps, I want to clear the sand away. And sure enough, he becomes the Pharaoh of Egypt. He becomes Thutmose IV. Now, the part of the story that is not emphasized is the fact that I've already told you, Thutmose IV, his dad, has already constructed a temple next to the Sphinx. So the Sphinx is being worshipped anyway. And the Egyptian Egyptologist Hassan Salim excavated the area of the Sphinx in the 1940s. And in his excavations, he encountered lots of these stelae, these monumental stones, dedicated in the name of Thutmose IV's brothers. So they all seem to have gone along and worshipped the Sphinx, but their names and their images were attacked. So it seems quite like Thutmose IV, you know, pushed some of his brothers out of the way in order to become the king. And then the bit of granite that he uses for his enormous stela, the famous one, the Dream Stela, the one that people know the history of, he actually recycled the stone from the Temple of Khafre. So he's maybe a recycler, certainly a bit sharp-elbowed, and that's the aspect of the story, in his ascent to the throne, using the Sphinx as a legitimating tool. Oh, the god said, if you do this, you'll become the legitimate king. Even later kings, kings like Ramesses II, engrave walls, create a little chapel, a little room in front of the walls at the paws of the Sphinx, where it's almost like every king of Egypt, when he eventually takes the throne, has to go for the blessing of the Sphinx, and the Sphinx will confirm the king's right to rule.
Oh, that's interesting. Even if it might be in slightly dubious, maybe even fratricidal circumstances.
Yes, maybe fratricidal.
That it revives. But it's interesting how even, you know, we mentioned names like Ramesses II. So when they've moved down to Luxor, to Thebes, further up the River Nile, they still go to the Great Sphinx. That's still an yes. important part of kingship for them. Yes. Which is interesting.
Yes, and we actually, despite all the many, many, many lines that have been written about this in Egyptology books, there's no actual evidence for a ritual that we'd call a coronation. It's not like Westminster Abbey. But maybe going to the Sphinx and having a kind of moment with the Sphinx, that is something like a coronation. Who knows?
Yeah, because it was like, I mean, later on, you know me, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm big on Alexander the Great and what happens.
Sure.
How his tomb in Alexandria becomes a place of pilgrimage for Romans and Greeks who admired Alexander. Maybe kind of a pilgrimage idea for the Sphinx too. We don't know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think Alexander has this famous story of going to Siwa, to the Oracle of Amun, and there's some kind of confirmation happens there. Who knows? I suspect if I was Alexander the Great, I would go to Giza and maybe there was some kind of equivalent, because the god represented, the Sphinx, the god, you know, manifested by the Sphinx, is much older than Amun in religious terms. So you get more legitimacy maybe from the pyramids and the monumental landscape of Giza.
So we see this whole revival of the Great Sphinx at the time of the New Kingdom. Do we see then the beginning of the reproduction of the image of the Sphinx on other statues at that time?
Yes, there's a great brand of what I guess we could call Sphinx tourism. So you get these small stelae, these commemorative, quite modest commemorative stones from the reign of Ramesses II, so a few years, a couple of centuries even after Thutmose IV, where people have themselves shown worshipping the Sphinx. And it seems in this case the people shown are scribes, and they go and visit the site of Saqqara, they go and visit the step pyramid of Djoser that's older even than the Sphinx, and then they go also to Giza, which would be a major tourist attraction, let's be frank. You would go take a picnic and have a, as people do today, have a holiday and go and visit, walking on the west of the city of Memphis. So the reproduction of the Sphinx as a form, I think, gets an added boost, a kind of added impetus from these visitors, these tourists going, literate tourists who maybe can read the inscriptions nearby.
And how do these later pharaohs, how do they embrace the Sphinx? Because I see later, you mentioned the name like Saqqara, and I've been to Luxor, and you see between Luxor and Karnak, you see this avenue of the Sphinxes. So what are these great avenues of Sphinxes? They are remarkable in their own way.
Yes, well, avenues of Sphinxes are familiar to modern tourists because that's what you see when you go to Luxor now. Interestingly, the person who seems to invent these is another favourite. Oh no. The favourite of mine, if I were to meet a historical personage from ancient Egypt, it wouldn't be Ramses the Great, it wouldn't be Khafre, it would be Queen Hatshepsut. I think she's such an interesting character. She invents the Avenue of Sphinxes, the first known processional route that's flanked on either side by dozens of sphinxes is hers, right? Now, there are interesting reasons for that. Hatshepsut is a female pharaoh. Not the only female pharaoh, but the most successful, undoubtedly. And she has this kind of iconographical conundrum. Maybe it seems like a conundrum to us, and wasn't a conundrum to her. She is of the female sex, but you can perform gender. She is a king, and kings are coded male. So she appears with male attributes. And the Sphinx, in a way, is a human head on a lion's body. And so it overcomes any question about sex or gender because it's just a superhuman body. And it seems that Hatshepsut is someone who really popularizes the Sphinx form. And it's after her that you get these Sphinx avenues. They do exist, to be clear. Sphinxes exist in the Middle Kingdom. The pharaoh can be shown as a Sphinx. So a few hundred years before Hatshepsut. And also princesses, royal women, can be shown as sphinxes. So it is not just men. I want to emphasize that. So after Hatshepsut, people like Ramesses II come along. Tutankhamun as well. Akhenaten even, the probable father of Tutankhamun. And they want sphinx avenues. And they focus between the temples of Luxor and Karnak down in the south of Egypt. And so often you read about these things being kind of protective guardians. It's not really that sphinxes are guardians. It's just that they manifest divinity. And one of the key purposes of the Avenue of Sphinxes is to allow images of gods, statues of gods, to be taken by priests on model boats and to be carried as part of rituals like the Opit Festival. Mm. And so the Sphinx Avenue just creates an area which wouldn't be used by many people. And this is always a problem. And I say to people who visit Egypt, everything is set up now for huge numbers, you know, thousands of tourists every day. You've been to Luxor, you know, it's really a busy tourist destination. These spaces were never made to be frequented by large numbers of people. You could go if you were a priest or a priestess. The point is to make an environment suitable for the gods. So the point of Sphinx Avenues is simply to, yeah, manifest divine power.
So does the Sphinx always kind of retain this, you know, royal importance? I was wondering, like the swan being owned by the royalty today.
Yeah.
Or was the fact that, in its long history and how it's reinvented by the ancient Egyptians, I mean, maybe not even elite nobles could portray themselves as a Sphinx. Is it only just royalty who could use this mythical animal?
Yes, that's a really good point, and I've not thought of it like that. You're right, only royalty. So the king, notably, the queen of Egypt, the king's wife, and a royal child, a daughter of the king, could also be shown at different points as a Sphinx. non-royal people, even the top echelons of, you know, the vizier, the kind of chief minister of Egypt, they are not permitted to be shown as sphinxes. No, you're right. Just royalty. Occasionally, very late on, you get a form, a kind of fully divine form of a god who takes off in the Ptolemaic and Roman period, of the god called Tutu. And this may be a play on the word for statue, actually. And he takes the form of a sphinx. So that's a god shown as a sphinx. But you're right, no, normal people, even wealthy, powerful people, are not shown as sphinxes.
Oh, interesting. I mean, of course, the main focus is the Great Sphinx at Giza. I mean, we have the Avenue of Sphinxes, and these sphinxes are smaller, but still really interesting. I'm pretty sure I've seen really small depictions of sphinxes too, almost as little statuettes. But is there ever any attempt to create another colossal depiction of a sphinx that at least we know of from ancient Egypt?
Nothing on that scale. There is one at Memphis. There's the second biggest, maybe, extant sphinx. May belong to Hatshepsut. I think Hatshepsut's a prime candidate for the identification, but there's no name preserved. Yeah, I mean, up in the north at Saqqara, you get an avenue of sphinxes. One resurgence, real resurgence in sphinx construction, in sphinx carving, seems to happen around the time of Dynasty 30.
Ah.
So King Necténebo,
number
first
one or two.
And second, one and two, they take a real interest in sphinxes, and then the early Ptolemies think this is, you know, the quintessential way an Egyptian pharaoh is shown. So as Macedonian Greeks, they want to get in with the Egyptians. And then it trails off. Occasionally you get later Ptolemies or maybe Roman emperors. But it's really a mass interest in sphinxes in this period around 350. 300 BC.
I didn't know that at all. So even though, like Ptolemy I, say, for instance, maybe not Alexander, but so even he, we have evidence of him portraying himself as a sphinx too.
Yes,
wow,
yeah.
I had no idea about that. It goes back to Hellenistic times as well.
Yeah.
So if we go on, you mentioned how it seems to kind of maybe fade away a bit in Roman times, but is it ever like fully engulfed by the sands? What do we know about its legacy as we go away from ancient history?
Well, I think the sphinx is unusual because it's a monument, like the pyramids, I guess, most big pyramids, they are never lost. They're never completely covered in sand. For a lot of its existence, I think the Great Sphinx of Giza would be covered up to the shoulders, but it gets cleared sporadically, certainly in the New Kingdom. But then we've got accounts in the Middle Ages in Arabic, where you have scholars from around the Middle East coming, traveling to Egypt, writing in Arabic, describing its features. Then as Europeans start visiting Egypt from the 1600s on, you get depictions of it. And then, as I say, it's an Egyptian Egyptologist, Salim Hassan, who excavates it. And then there are these very iconic pictures, even from the Second World War, where it's sandbagged up to its chin. So just in case there's some fighting that might threaten the actual integrity of it. And now it's in this enclosure where you can visit with a ticket, but you can still see it from far away. So even though direct access to it is restricted and would have been an ancient privilege, you can still see it, and maybe you can address your prayers to it from afar. It's something that is so iconic of ancient Egypt. Images of it are so often reproduced. It's lovely when you're there and people are blown away by just being in the presence of the Sphinx. It's got a real power that maybe other monuments don't.
I think you're right, it does. I remember looking over that Giza plateau and when the sun was setting as well, and you see obviously the sun kind of on the pyramids, but then you see the Sphinx in the foreground, and it is an absolutely astonishing thing to actually see in the flesh. And it's interesting also that legacy, as we kind of wrap up now, it's also, my mind always goes to that Napoleon painting, isn't it, when he's
yes.
in front of the Sphinx, and it is just almost the head that's still there. I mean, do we know from the records when the nose is lost? Because if it's always mentioned that different people see it? Or
I mean, it depends which accounts you believe. There seems to have been damage done in the Middle Ages, but this idea that it was the French or the British doing target practice using cannons, there's no definitive evidence of that, I don't think. But the fact that it survived in such relatively good condition for over 4,500 years is... it's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing in itself. Campbell, this has been absolutely brilliant. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about the Sphinx before we completely wrap up?
No, I mean, if you can, just go and visit it. It's really worth a visit. And in the Cairo Museum, the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, possibly about to be moved to the new Grand Museum, which is just down the road from the Sphinx at Giza, about to be opened very soon, we hope. There is a depiction of a scribe from the reign of Ramses II, and it is the only depiction of the Sphinx with the two pyramids in the background. And it's such an iconic image, but so rarely depicted by the Egyptians themselves. Look out for that the next time, or if you manage to get to Cairo.
What a chestnut to leave it on. And last, but certainly not least, talk to us a bit about your exhibition Golden Mummies that is ongoing at Manchester Museum.
Yes, so our exhibition Golden Mummies of Egypt is closing in the middle of April 2024. So, and then I have a book coming out with the great Greg Jenner. Greg is starting a new history series, Totally Chaotic History. And the first book, Ancient Egypt Gets Unruly, comes out in April.
Well, Campbell, this has been awesome. And it just goes me to say thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast today.
Pleasure.
Well, there you go. There was Dr. Campbell Price talking all things the Great Sphinx of Giza, as I mentioned at the start, an encore episode to our Wonders of the World mini-series. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, last thing from me, wherever you're listening to The Ancients, whether that be on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify or elsewhere, make sure that you are subscribed, that you click that follow button so that you don't miss out when we release new episodes twice every week. And also, make sure to share these episodes if you've enjoyed them.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With as many people as possible. But that's enough from me. And I will see you in the next episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.